Now, they tell me it's polite to actually kiss the winners when you hand over the award, so I know who I'm hoping for. Here we go. And the winner of the Box Best Video Award is, thank you, God, the Spice Girls for Say You'll Be There.
At the 1997 Brit Awards, the ones where Ginger Spice wore her iconic Union Jack dress during the Spice Girls performance, the band won two awards, which meant two speeches. Here's how their first speech ended.
I want to say a massive thanks to Virgin Records and the best manager in the whole wide world, Simon Fuller. God bless Britain!
Makes sense. And it pretty well lines up with Ginger's overtly patriotic sartorial choices. Britain's other biggest band at the time, Oasis, Cool Britannia's swaggering headliners never shy about using the Union Jack themselves, well, they weren't all there in the crowd to celebrate. As a matter of fact, one of the Gallagher brothers, Liam, had told the press he wouldn't be attending the show because,
if I bump into the Spice Girls, I will smack them.
So, at the end of the band's second speech, Sporty Spice, appropriately I think, unleashed a torrent of girl power.
I just want to say, Liam, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough.
If only for challenging one of Britain's most famous lads to back up his bratty swagger, Melanie Chisholm should have been a feminist icon. Unfortunately, the only group more suspicious, if not as violently suspicious, of the Spice Girls than Britpop royalty was feminists. Not all of them, but a lot of them. What they saw at that podium was this. A dilution of feminism, brought to you by Pepsi Cola, shouting the name of their manager Simon Fuller to high heaven, who with every move fed this media frenzy that all it was doing was lining the pockets of record executives. And guess what gender those record executives probably were. This episode, why Britpop orphaned the very British, very popular Spice Girls, and why feminists refused to adopt them. Welcome back to Iconography, a podcast dedicated to the geography of icons, real and imagined. This is part two of a two-part exploration of the Spice Girls and girl power, so if you haven't heard part one yet, go ahead and give that a listen first. My goal in part one was to deconstruct, and by that I mean to unpack, yes, but also, hopefully literally to demolish, some of the assumptions that led people to dismiss the Spice Girls as a manufactured girl group, emphasis on man, as in controlled by men. For another example of how untrue this assumption was in practice, we need only look at that Union Jack dress from the 1997 Brit Awards, which was eventually auctioned off for the highest price any piece of pop star clothing would ever fetch.
Let's talk about the famous dress,
Union Jack dress.
I know. The funny thing about that dress, it was the first time we got given a lot of designer, like, clothes, and I had this idea that I said, no, I want to wear, you know, a Union Jack. And I got told, no, that's a bad idea by this stylist. So I stitched it onto the black Gucci dress and wore it anyway. So it's quite funny. It's made out of a tea towel. Which cost me £5.
The people telling Jerry Halliwell not to wear a Union Jack in this antidote weren't thinking, oh no, you'll ruin a perfectly good Gucci dress. They were thinking, things have settled down somewhat in the last few years, but a Union Jack? That is still a political minefield. And look, Jerry and her sister were savvy enough to know that, even as they did what they darn well pleased. It's why there was a peace sign sewn onto the dress's back. We're going to need to go back another 5 years to 1992 to understand why flaunting this flag, the flag of Britain, hardly an underground symbol, why that was, if not done with extreme care, essentially seen as the equivalent of spitting in the face of an immigrant. August 1992, in Finsbury Park, London. This is madness. No, really, madness. a popular ska band from the late 70s and early 80s is reuniting, and this is their reunion gig, Mad Stop. But also, this is sort of, you know, madness. Morrissey, formerly lead singer of the Smiths, one of the most popular and beloved British musical acts of the 80s and of all time, he's up on the stage waving around the British flag. And he throws the flag into a crowd of cheering skinheads who are just eating this up. A bunch of things here probably seem out of place to you if you're American. Why would waving around the flag of one's nation be a problem? And why is Morrissey anywhere near skinheads? So, skinhead has not always meant what it essentially means in America in the 21st century, pretty much a neo-Nazi. It still doesn't really mean that in England. In markets, you can find skinhead fashion stores like the one I ran across in Camden Market this week. Skinhead is an aesthetic that evolved out of the harder end of the mod crowd. They became one of the 70s most recognizable, feared, and misunderstood youth cults. That's from The People's Songs by music writer Stuart McConey, who actually coined the term Britpop. We'll be hearing quite a lot from him this episode. Skinheads, too, valued smartness and style, but they rejected the artistic and cultural aesthetic of the mods. Theirs was a more macho, conservative, and aggressive attitude to the world around them. Eventually, and ironically, what began as a celebration of characteristic working-class style and self-assertion curdled into a narrow cult of nationalism and violence against perceived outsiders, hippies, immigrants, and gay people. By this point in 1992, for many of those in the crowd, skinheadedness has morphed from a posture into an ideology, one that's closely tied to the far-right political party, the National Front, which coalesced around fears that immigrants were taking over the country and is considered neo-fascist by political scientists. Sorry if you're getting some 2017 feelings there, I can't help it. So what is Morrissey doing in front of this crowd? In our time, saying you love the Smiths is shorthand for, I'm with it, man. I get it.
I love the Smiths.
Sorry?
I said
when
I
think
Smiths.
Of Morrissey, I don't think of skinheads or racism, which are decidedly not with it.
You've good taste in music.
You like the Smiths.
Yeah. To die by
I think of 500 Days of Summer, where Tom is love-struck when he finds out that Summer loves the Smiths.
Holy.
But the truth is, ever since the start of his solo career in 1988, Morrissey has been flirting with what he considered nuanced character studies of people who are not him, but which his audience, which this audience of skinheads in 1992, probably think of as anthems, affirming their beliefs that immigrants do not belong here. Bengali in Platforms, sample lyric, Life is Hard Enough When You Belong Here, is about an immigrant who does not fit in. The National Front Disco features as its refrain, England for the English, England. Now, if his songwriting was flirtation, then this flag stunt at Finsbury is consummation. And reaction is swift. To call New Music Express NME Smith's devotees to this point would be a severe understatement, but the NME cover that features Morrissey holding the flag scolds, Morrissey, flying the flag or flirting with disaster? The story criticizes Morrissey for continuing to pick away at the scab of race relations in this country. Think for a moment about that flag. For many people living in England, that was the flag that symbolized the oppression of your people for over a century. And now that the empire has sputtered out, a bunch of sword losers have co-opted the flag, so now it says, fine, if you won't let us rule you, stay out. That's what the members of Corner Shop, a proudly British Indian band who would have a number one hit in 1998, that's what they were thinking about, that and Bengali in Platforms, when they stood outside Morrissey's label EMI and burned his picture. And This was an extreme case of what incorporating a Union Jack into your art could lead to. A lot of this came from the context of Morrissey's work and statements, which have continued to lean in very Nigel Farage directions, to the extent of supporting Farage and Brexit. Here is Morrissey in 2007, for example.
With the issue of immigration, it's very difficult because, although I don't have anything against people from other countries, the higher the influx into England, the more the British identity disappears. If you travel to Germany, it's still absolutely Germany. If you travel to Sweden, it still has a Swedish identity. But travel to England and you'd have no idea where you are. If you walk through Knightsbridge, you'll hear every accent apart from an English accent.
But it wasn't just a Morrissey thing. There was something about the flag itself. After years as the symbol of the British Empire, of colonialism swallowing the world, and then years at the front of National Front rallies and marches, telling anyone who wasn't white and British to stay the hell away, many British people simply did not feel they could be proud of the Union Jack. Being proud of the nation could very easily be interpreted as dabbling in nationalism. Come 1993, the Gallagher brothers, one of whom we met earlier threatening to slap the Spice Girls, they wanted to change this. The cover of the first Oasis demo tape features the Union Jack being sucked down a drain. Liam explained,
"It's the greatest flag in the world. It's going down the shitter. We're here to do something about it."
I don't need to tell you what kind of music was popular in 1993, right?
It's like grunge is... it's really kind of boring for us, you know, it's something we can't deny, and we're not going to stop playing the old songs live.
That year, Stuart McConey, the music writer who explained skinhead culture earlier, embarked on a similar mission of reclaiming British pride. He had been deputy editor of NME.
"Every week we seem to feature surly whiners in plaid shirts, making dire complaint rock whose message seemed to be, 'I don't want to tidy my room.' And it wasn't even homegrown whinging. It came not from Sheffield, Croydon, or Manchester, but Los Angeles and Seattle. And in the words of Morrissey, said nothing to me about my life. This wasn't just me being a little Englander, as my grunge-loving workmates at NME claimed. I genuinely couldn't relate to this stuff. To make matters worse, we had new British bands who were cleverer, cooler, funnier, and made far better music. There was a gang of misfits from Yorkshire called Pulp, whose song My Legendary Girlfriend I'd made single of the week to hoots of derision and cries of losers.
You know, sometimes, when we're lying together..."
McConey left NME after that, and he put together an ode to homegrown bands for Select magazine. On the cover was Brett Anderson of Suede, looking whippet thin, whip smart, and sunken-cheeked cool, in McConey's words. The headline? "Yanks go home! Suede, Saint-Etienne, Denim, Pulp, the Auteurs, and the Battle for Britain." The background? A Union Jack. Inside? The story that coined the term Britpop. According to McConey, Suede, while enjoying the acclaim and publicity, were peeved with me, perhaps understandably, at being associated with a flag that at that point was seen as the preserve of the far right. Considering Britpop's founding mission was to redeem British national pride and the national flag from nationalists, one might reasonably assume that Ginger Spice's Gucci dress with a flag tea towel sewn on, not to mention the freaking Spice Bus from the Spice World movie, which was a giant mobile Union Jack, they'd be considered the apotheosis of Britpop. When associated with the Spice Girls, the flag didn't say, "Keep out, England for the English." It said, "What are you waiting for? Come on over, join this party." If you knew nothing else about Britpop, other than that it was meant to be British and popular, and generally the opposite of grunge, then you'd probably start getting your chisel ready so you could put the Spice Girls on Britpop's Mount Rushmore next to Oasis and Blur and Suede and Pulp and Elastica. Unfortunately, there would be people there willing to fight you to keep the Spice Girls off. People like Sylvia Patterson, who considered writing a book called
Zig-a-Zig, Ah, How the Spice Girls Ruined Everything.
in an article titled, "The 1990s were the best of times until the Spice Girls ruined everything." You might be sensing a theme here. Patterson writes, "The year Kurt Cobain took his own life, 1994, seeing off glum-faced grunge, British culture jackknifed overnight, the Pied Pipers of Britpop leading a nationwide party on a yellow brick road of hedonistic invincibility, a last great movement in outsider rock and roll tribalism. The Spice Girls changed everything. Arriving in 1996, they were created ostensibly as a female take that whose vaguely positive, ultimately meaningless girl power slogan belied their true legacy. They were the original pioneers of the band as brand, of pop as a ruthless marketing ruse, of the merchandising and sponsorship deals that have dominated commercial pop ever since." Or, to borrow the refrain of another song popular in 1996, essentially, before 1996, the public cared about authenticity, man. About British songwriters writing British songs from their British hearts. And then the Spice Girls came along, and en masse, everyone was suddenly okay with, suddenly craved, multinational, label-driven drivel. What we're doing here is we're getting back into those gendered assumptions that we talked about in part one. Assumptions that lead to lines like these in the New York Times. "The fastest, easiest way for a woman to climb the charts is still by being part of a man-made, prefabricated confection like the Spice Girls. The Beavis and Butthead crowd of 10 to 14-year-old boys can listen to the jiggling Spice Girls, a British import notable for their chirpy, bubblegum sound." I'd say these are veiled knocks at the band's lack of artistry, lack of intelligence, and lack of appeal to anyone but horny boys, but it's not even veiled. Mel B wasn't far off the money when she told the very same New York Times, "You've got to get people to treat you like you've got a brain. Sometimes we get treated as bimbos, and we're not bimbos." This isn't to say that there wasn't a paradigm shift. There most certainly was. But it wasn't from sophistication to idiocy. Doors weren't closing. They were opening. There had been a female voice in Britpop in bands like Elastica, but the overriding presumption of the Britpop industry, and make no mistake, it was an industry, was that women wanted to buy music and magazine covers that featured handsome men, and that men would buy rock music as long as it sounded like music that was made for men. Kate Thornton was editor of Smash Hits magazine when the Spice Girls broke out in 1996. "They were a wind machine of ambition, refusing to take no for an answer. My bosses had doubts, namely that they were female. At that time, teenage girls bought pop magazines when they had pretty boys on the cover. The last thing my bosses expected was for readers to react to five women. So I told the Spice Girls they had to get to number one first. And the following month, they did just that. Wannabe hit the top spot in 37 countries, and their debut album, Spice, sold more than 30 million copies worldwide, making it the best-selling album by a female group in history."
The Spice Girls revealed an untapped market, one that All Saints, Girls Aloud, Bewitched, Billie Piper, and yes, Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera would happily tap into. But that didn't kill Britpop. People were perfectly capable of buying both Spice Girls albums and Blur albums if they wanted to. According to Stuart McConey, the man that first declared Britpop in session, Britpop killed itself.
"It stopped being quirky, especially when all the lads' mags jumped on it and Oasis was playing at Nebworth. Britpop got too big for its own boots. And then, Tony Blair and New Labour hijacked it completely, and it just got embarrassing."
Essentially, two things happened. One, the music crawled up its own ass. In his History of Pop Music, Yeah, 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 Bob Stanley gives 1998 as Britpop's date of death.
"The curtain fell on Britpop with Pulp's 1998 album This Is Hardcore, detailing a band's virtual and artistic disintegration in the spotlight. It was in stark contrast to the high gloss and chipperness of Spice World the movie. Did the British public want to listen to a singer moaning about how many Bukkake videos he'd watched while bored in an Amsterdam hotel room? No, it did not. It wanted to see 16-year-old Billy Piper's unfeasible United Kingdom-sized smile.
Problem number two. The artists did what outsiders can never, ever do. They became part of the establishment. They went from lying post-coitally on Union Jack bedsheets, as Liam Gallagher and then-girlfriend Patsy Kensit had done on the famous London Swings Again cover of Vanity Fair, to lying in bed with the Union itself.
There are seven people in this room tonight who are giving a little bit of hope to young people in this country. That is me, our kid, Bonehead, Quigsy, Alan White, Alan McGee and Tony Blair. And if you'd all got anything about you, you get up there and you shake Tony Blair's hand, man. He's a man.
Tony Blair's team actually had an entertainment wrangler, Darren Callinuck, a man who made sure that the politician could successfully draft off the Cool Britannia movement right into office. And Blair won his race. Britpop was exhausted. It was spent. Funnily enough, Tony Blair was kind of the only thing that Oasis and Blur could agree on. If you thought Liam's slapping comments regarding the Spice Girls were bad, his brother Noel had once wished the members of Blur would
get AIDS and die.
But the Spice Girls were the big British band that didn't toe the New Labour line. They did their own thing. They were openly suspicious of Blair, and they idolized Maggie Thatcher, and because I know you'll find this amusing, Ginger Spice pinched Prince Charles's royal bottom and planted a kiss on his cheek upon meeting him. Like the tea towel sewn onto the Gucci dress, and all the wonderful quotes and moments from last episode's Rolling Stone profile, and of course, the fateful night when Jerry broke in and stole the band's masters before firing their first managers and becoming the band's manager herself for a spell, this was pure Jerry Halliwell. No one told her to do these things. Anyone who told Jerry to pinch the royal bottom might have been tried for high crimes. So I don't hear the same thing as Sylvia Patterson, who thinks the Spice Girls ruined everything, when I hear Noel Gallagher complain in 2001
that the man has taken over the world.
She hears a genius
pinpointing the trends and forces that have led us to the present day, hollering over the corporate takeover of not only the music industry but the actual planet, boiling in indignation over insatiable consumerism, hypercapitalism, celebrity culture, and the peddlers of weedy career rock.
For my part, I hear a genius, and make no mistake, I love Oasis's music, that's whining that his genius isn't being recognized anymore because now girls are out there buying girl music.
The man has taken over the world.
The one thing, probably the only thing, upon which a Gallagher brother and a third-wave feminist could find common ground in 2001. Of course, the emphasis was different. Gallagher's man was anyone, male or female, who would overlook artistry for the bottom line. Feminists would have probably been fine with that if they felt anyone but men were truly benefiting long-term. Essentially, for a Gallagher brother, the issue was how famous the Spice Girls became. A killer rock band, Oasis, should have been that famous. But for many feminists observing the girl power phenomena, the issue was that the Spice Girls became famous at all. Maybe fame wasn't supposed to be the goal, if fame meant bowing down to male-led record companies and a male-led press corps. I take great pleasure in letting some of the air out of the argument that the Spice Girls weren't good Britpop artists. It's much harder, though, to contradict the argument that they weren't good feminist icons. And the reason is that they undoubtedly did do the thing that they were accused of. They diluted girl power down from a radical feminist rallying cry, a howl that wasn't supposed to make you feel comfortable. And they watered it down into a marketing-friendly slogan that anyone could feel comfortable shouting and wearing on their Girl Power t-shirt, only $20 at a retailer near you. This is the rationale the Spice Girls gave for Girl Power in their book, Girl Power.
Feminism has become a dirty word. Girl Power is just a 90s way of saying it. We can give feminism a kick up the arse.
Jerry Halliwell, the main force behind the Spice Girls' girl power ethos, didn't pull those specific words, girl and power, magically out of the ether. The phrase had come to her through a sort of transatlantic game of telephone.
Hey, girlfriend! I got a brother that
first, from a DIY punk scene in Olympia, Washington, that, after a point, spurned any and all media attention. And then to two teenage girls from England who Peter Levine, former editor of Top of the Pops magazine, says were
so rebellious they just weren't likable to a wider audience.
And then finally, to Jerry and the Spice Girls. A genuine media phenomena that found the widest audience the 90s could possibly offer. As with any game of telephone, some bits of the message got dropped at each stop. And the end result, it made people smile, right? Even if it didn't make quite as much sense as the initial message. To understand what was lost, maybe what was gained along the way, we have to go back one more time to 1992.
Okay, sorry. Okay, we're starting now. We're Bikini Kill, and we want revolution! Girls don't know!
That is when the Riot Girl movement, a feminist punk movement which had been growing for about 2 years, mostly by word of mouth and through self-published zines, that's when it first gained major media attention. Girl isn't spelled G-I-R-L, by the way. It's spelled G-R-L. It was a growl. The movement's credo was revolution, girl style, now. It was in this milieu that girl power first gained traction as a phrase amongst a much smaller, much more radical audience than it would 4 years later. Before we do the easy thing and identify the differences between Riot Girl bands and the Spice Girls, I want to highlight one striking similarity. One of Riot Girl's most prominent acts was Bikini Kill. Kathleen Hanna, Toby Vail, Kathy Wilcox, and Billy Karen. In an interview for the book Girl Power, this is Marissa Meltzer's history of the Riot Girl scene, not the one that the Spice Girls wrote, Toby Vail recounted,
"We really did sit down and say, how can we change what it means to be a girl? And how can we reinvent feminism for our generation?"
In a separate interview with Vice, Kathleen Hanna remembers,
"Toby and I were discussing what word just felt totally wrong next to girl, and we came up with power."
This is just a different way of saying what the Spice Girls would say in 1997.
"We can give feminism a kick up the ass."
And the Spice Girls weren't misinformed when they claimed feminism had become a dirty word either. Kathleen Hanna agrees.
"In the 90s, there was this huge backlash against feminism. There was this belief that women were already equal."
Basically, if you were still a feminist after all that had been done for women already, then you must be one of the anti-men extremists who want to keep all the men underground as sex slaves. Feminism was seen as the domain of white academics, leaving it little room to grow. In 1989, before Riot Girl formed, Time magazine asked on their cover, "Is there a future for feminism?" And in 1998, after Jerry left the Spice Girls, Time magazine asked on their cover, "Is feminism dead?" The mission of Riot Girl and Spice Girl had similar elements. Make feminism's ideas more approachable to a wider audience under a new name. Make feminism catchier. The differences came in what they were going to say and how much they would compromise with outside forces to be heard. Punks through and through, Riot Girls were not trying to be liked, and they were not trying to be mainstream. If men at their gigs heckled or pushed, bands would stop playing until the men moved to the back of the room and let all the women come to the front.
"All girls to the front. I'm not kidding. All girls to the front. All boys, be cool for once in your lives. Go back."
And when it came to mainstream media outlets like the New York Times and Rolling Stone, Riot Girls were not liked and not taken seriously. In one story in Melody Maker, Hannah mused,
"We in Bikini Kill have got this feeling that they're going to start manufacturing a riot Barbie. And she'll come packaged with a little beat-up guitar, some miniature spray paints that don't work, and a miniature list of dumb revolutionary slogans like, Riot Coke, just for the taste of it.
It all got so bad that Hannah declared a media blackout in 1992. This wasn't a popular decision amongst all Riot Girls, it basically split the scene in two, but the fact that a group of professional musicians would ever consider not using established media outlets to publicize their work should pretty much tell you all you need to know about where Riot Girls and Spice Girls did not see eye to eye. For the record, Jerry Halliwell knew about absolutely none of this when she dreamed up the Spice Girls image. According to Jerry, the notion of girl power was delivered to her by the band Shampoo.
I saw them and I thought, oh my god, that is so good.
What she saw in 1994 was this. Two self-professed British megababes, Jackie and Carrie, both teenagers, but on the almost 20 end. Shampoo was not as political as the Riot Girls who inspired the chorus of their song, Girl Power. And considering how much Bikini Kill resented the notion of being tied in any way to Barbie, they probably would have been absolutely disgusted with Shampoo's very public obsession with all things Barbie. But Shampoo was still plenty abrasive. Ginger Spice may have thought that Shampoo was so good, but a lot of people did not agree. One magazine profile from the time took in some of the comments in the room as they performed in Clacton-on-Sea.
They're bimbos. They can't sing. They can't dance. Their song is shit.
Oi, you're useless, you are.
I'd have enjoyed it if I was shagging them.
Jackie and Carrie were clearly pushing buttons in hopes of riling up some feelings like this. They were foregoing Britpop's androgyny for an extreme, in-your-face, Barbie-loving femininity. Wearing shirts that said Dolly Bird and Tart. But they were likely doing this in hopes of provoking the thought, sexiness can be awesome. Girl power can be sexy. Not provoking boos. Their first line in that profile is really a downer, considering how young they were.
Why does everyone hate us so much?
According to Sylvia Patterson, who, as you'll recall, thinks the Spice Girls ruined everything, it all comes down to money. In which the Spice Girls would end up swimming. Shampoo started out on a really small indie label, and because they were sullen and miserable, no way could they be as relatable as the backflipping, in-your-faceness of the Spices. This is where the Spice Girls backflip in, winning sponsorships and movie deals not long after they break out in the summer of 1996. The backlash against their use of girl power in that context is swift and it's fierce. Because in the eyes of people who have followed girl power from its radical origins in self-published zines, this slogan that had been used to sell feminism, well, now it's being used to sell stuff that says girl power on it.
The Spice Can from Polaroid.
Riot Girl had spurned the media and sponsorships, choosing to spread their message through zines and shows and records exclusively. They controlled their message. In comparison, the Spice Girls must have looked a little bit like the plot of the 2001 satire Josie and the Pussycats ended up looking. Kick-ass females kicking ass in the foreground. But only as a means of Trojan horsing in insidious messaging that tells people what shoes and soft drinks to buy in the background.
The government has been planting small subliminal advertising suggestions in today's rock music. The results? We can now get these kids to buy just about anything. We can have them chasing a new trend every week.
And there wasn't an evil plot involving subliminal messaging, sure. But, you know, there wasn't not a plot. It wasn't evil, but it was certainly shrewd, and it might have very well involved messaging that some consumers may not have been aware that they were consuming. Come 2000, this phenomena was labeled Spice Girls Pencil Set Syndrome by Jennifer Bumgardner and Amy Richards in Manifesta. That's a darn good name. It evokes perfectly what the issue at hand is. Does the Spice Girls brand of girl power make people think about sexual harassment, or does it make them want to buy a branded pencil set? The question here is not whether the Spice Girls had sponsorships. They did.
Girls, why you signed for Pepsi Cola?
Why not?
Because they're cool and young.
It's
and
young
like
and fun. And it's like us, it's a very music-orientated Pepsi.
Yeah, it's always had a history of music.
And it's not whether those sponsorships mattered to them. They did.
And what do you think Pepsi can offer you?
I think, you know, Pepsi...
A lot of money.
As an example, in that Rolling Stone profile that we examined at length in part one, Chris Heath makes this point of highlighting this really remarkable and kind of sad moment. So of all the things that he hears, including that Mel B uses dirty underwear as a scrunchie after she washes her hair, there's only one thing that the band wants to retract to take off the record. And that's this.
Anyone for Coke?
The other four members immediately chide Baby Spice for her mistake. The band's biggest sponsor is Pepsi. Heath says Emma keeps repeating,
Pepsi, Pepsi, Pepsi,
to herself. In my opinion, the real question is this. Were the Spice Girls unable to sell the version of feminism they truly wanted to sell because they were also selling Pepsi? Did Pepsi ever stop them from decrying harassment or rape or the wage gap because they were a Pepsi act? And Pepsi acts don't do that. If so, that's a major issue, a compromise as betrayal. If not, then maybe Pepsi didn't game the Spice Girls. Maybe the Spice Girls ended up gaming Pepsi in the long run. Think of it this way. What if the Spice Girls got to say everything they ever wanted to say about feminism, undiluted, and they got Pepsi to give that message a signal boost while paying them? Sure, from 1996 to 2000, the band sold a lot of Pepsi soft drinks. But by featuring the Spice Girls, Pepsi ads sold feminism to everyone who saw them, free of charge. That's actually how Simon Fuller, the Spice Girls manager at the time, sees it.
A lot of money was made, but my thinking was, if we can get Pepsi to spend $40 million basically running what was a commercial for my group, then hallelujah.
Maybe by being everywhere, the Spice Girls acted as a gateway to feminism for people, boys and girls alike, who didn't know they were learning about feminism. Not everything feminism could be, of course, though, as Lisa Whittington Hall points out in a defense of the band called Gateway Spice,
were 8-year-old Spice Girls fans supposed to be listening to songs about sexual abuse and reclaiming the word slut?
Some of the crucial foundational elements were there, though.
The Spice Girls' message stressed friendship, positivity, determination, and being true to yourself. I think even Riot Girls would agree these aren't necessarily bad messages for preteen girls to embrace.
Riot Girl, in its purest form, was like a sniper rifle. It was laser-focused, capable of aiming straight for the heart of people who heard the message. But without sponsorships, without major record labels, and without the mainstream media, how many people could it really hit? The Spice Girls were like buckshot, erratic, and unlikely to hit everyone where they were meant to be hit, but boy, they ended up clipping so many people and leaving these little pieces of shrapnel there that grew into something bigger. This seems to be the case for some of my friends who replied when I asked for their Spice memories. One friend said,
"The Spice Girls were my first experience with a girl power movement, feeling that a girl can do anything."
Another friend mused,
"Honestly, my first exposure to feminist theory, especially third wave feminism, was through the Spice Girls."
She describes a 12-year-old discovering powerful messages, such as the notion that embracing sex appeal and femininity wasn't a feminist disqualifier, through op-eds and interviews that dealt with the band. Lauren Mayberry, lead singer and songwriter for Churches, has said something similar.
"I was exactly the target demographic for the Spice Girls when they came out. Whenever people ask me how I discovered feminist ideas, I wish I had more profound stories to tell them, but Most of the stuff I picked up on was through pop culture.
The Vice article, How the Spice Girls Ripped Girl Power from Its Radical Roots, is, as you can tell from the title, largely suspicious of the Spice Girls' use of girl power, but it concludes that
critiques of the Spice Girls are valid and necessary, but what they so often miss is a very simple fact. That girl power was never intended to be an academic feminist perspective. It was never meant to promote a post-structuralist vision of a utopian future where male hegemony was overthrown. It was pop music made for little girls to inspire them to be confident and believe in their abilities and support their friends.
Even Bikini Kill's Kathleen Hanna, who came up with Girl Power version 1.0, essentially agrees with this vision of Girl Power version 3.0, Spice Edition. As long as
little girls are turning it into something that works for them. Or if people hear girl power and they want to know more about it, so they go to the library instead of going to the mall.
Remember that Hannah's goal with Bikini Kill was to help feminism escape its academic cloister and become an approachable concept again. In hindsight, you don't have to like all the Spice Girls music. It's not all great. And you don't have to like the Spice World movie, which is a pretty poorly made film. But you have to concede that even if they pushed harder for Walker's chips than they did for equal pay, they did go a long way towards achieving Kathleen Hanna's mission. But as we've seen over and over again through the last two episodes, for people living through peak Spice Girls in 1996 and 1997 and even through the early 2000s, it took a remarkable eye to see that potential. Most people saw a manufactured band. They saw Simon Fuller's puppets. Pop-Tarts, as they were called on the Rolling Stone cover. One of the most aggravating things you can do if your esteem for the Spice Girls has been swelling is go on YouTube and watch a documentary from 2002 called 7 Days That Shook the Spice Girls. One of the chosen days is a pretty obvious one, a day we've already mentioned. The day in 1995 when the band stole their masters and fired their managers, deciding to go it on their own until they found something better, trusting their vision and their gumption. And the Talking Heads are all like, how cool, you know, how brave. And then at the end of the documentary, as a way of sounding the group's death knell, they tell us how, in late 1997, the Spice Girls fired their manager and had the audacity to trust their vision and their gumption. And those same Talking Heads suddenly can't believe the Spice Girls ever thought they were the reason for their own success. How could they ever believe they would be anything without Simon Fuller?
The most significant point of all for me was that they lost Simon Fuller in that process. And I don't think that Simon would have made the third album the way it was. So to me, it was a bit of a kind of sad ending to it all.
This is rank hypocrisy, obviously. But this is how we are trained to think about pop stars, especially of the beautiful female variety. Impressionable, malleable, disposable, expendable. Cogs in the machine, you know, molded by their agents, managers, and producers into presentable packages until their expiration date, and then we throw them away. As an antidote to that vial of poison, do yourself a favor and check out the Vogue profile that Kathy Acker wrote on the Spice Girls in 1997. Acker was exactly the sort of writer who you would expect to blow off the Spice Girls as bad for feminism without a second thought. According to one quote, she was part rebel bohemian avant-gardiste, part NYC downtown punk, and part venerable literary grand dame. And instead of that, Acker, who actually died soon after this piece was written of cancer, left us this wonderful gift. This is a piece in which a genius at the vanguard of feminist thought took the Spice Girls seriously as, you know, geniuses at the forefront of a different sort of feminist thought. Not fake seriously either, like that London Spectator article from last episode where the band were interviewed as if they were economists or politicians. No,
completely on the level. Like, these women might be the next step for feminism, and they know it, and they mean it. So to end our time with the Spice Girls, here's some of the end of that article.
The Spices, though they deny it, are babes. The blonde, the redhead, the dark, sultry fashion model. And they're more. They both are and represent a voice that has too long been repressed. The voices, not really the voice, of young women and, just as important, of women not from the educated class. It isn't only the lads sitting behind babe culture, bless them, who think that babes or beautiful lower and lower middle class girls are dumb. It's also educated women who look down on girls like the Spice Girls who think that because, for instance, girls like the Spice Girls take their clothes off, there can't be anything up there. The Spice Girls are having their cake and eating it. They have the popularity and the popular ear that an intellectual, certainly a female intellectual, almost never has in this society. And what's more, they have found themselves, perhaps by fluke, in the position of social and political articulation. It little matters now how the Spice Girls started, if they were a manufactured band. I am speculating, but perhaps due to Margaret Thatcher, though it is hard to attribute anything decent to her, a populist change has taken place in England. The Spice Girls and girls like them, and the girls who like them, resemble their American counterparts in two ways. They are sexually curious, certainly pro-sex, and they do not feel that they are stupid or that they should not be heard because they did not attend the right universities. If any of this speculation is valid, then it is up to feminism to grow, to take on what the Spice Girls and women like them are saying, and to do what feminism has always done in England. To keep on transforming society as society is best transformed, with lightness and joy.
Well, that's all for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed all this time we've spent with the Spice Girls, the people who influenced them, and the people who they influenced. This has been a really rich vein of research for me. Even this song we're listening to right now has so many facets. It is both the Spice Girls' clearest articulation of this idea of a new generation's feminism, and it was a song that was written for Pepsi to sell Pepsi. That these things can coexist is, well, kind of what I've been trying to explore all along. If you've liked what you've heard, then please be sure to rate and review the podcast in iTunes. A special thanks to my wife Carolyn for all her help on this episode, voicing the members of Bikini Kill, voicing Kathy Acker and Baby Spice, among others. I should also point out that it was her enthusiasm for the Spice Girls that inspired these two episodes in the first place. One bit of housekeeping before we go. I have a job in London now, which is really great, but it may throw the production schedule for a loop. For the time being, I will continue to aim for a bi-weekly release, but look for updates on the Facebook page, facebook.com/iconographypodcast, if that changes. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.